Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A measure allowing student athletes to make money from their name, image, and likeness advanced in the Senate today after its first committee stop.
Their body is beaten down during these sports times, so they should be able to earn some money while they're at the height of their career.
Also tonight, lawmakers debate how to set up a ranking and regulating system for the state's pre-kindergartens.
The bill sponsor has really responded quickly and has worked hard with all of the stakeholders to try to make this bill incredibly meaningful.
We'll also discover that at least one former Tallahassee lawmaker may not have waited the legal amount of time before returning as a paid lobbyist, and we'll tune into a new national TV network just launched from Tallahassee. It's the start of week five in the nine-week Florida lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. An issue that sparked national debate is speeding along in Tallahassee. The Florida Senate is moving its version of a plan allowing college athletes to receive pay for their name, image, and likeness. Florida is trying to follow California, which passed a law allowing student athletes to earn money from endorsements. Blaze Ganey has the details.
Senator Debbie Mayfield says it was her son who convinced her to file legislation allowing college athletes to be paid.
He said their body is beaten down during these sports times, so they should be able to earn some money while they're at the height of their career.
Under the proposal, student athletes would be allowed to be paid to appear in advertisement for businesses. The move could be profitable for players who receive national and sometimes worldwide recognition. Those who would want to enter into a contract with a private business would have to follow a few rules.
The student athlete may not enter into a contract that violates provisions of the team's contract. The team must disclose each potential conflict with the athlete and their representation. The student athlete must disclose any contracts they are part of to the university.
That's the so-called morality clause. The House is considering adding similar language to its proposals. Mayfield believes student athletes deserve the freedom to make money like any other person.
When you look at the fact that the universities are making millions off of these student athletes on their ability, and yes, they're getting a scholarship, and yes, they're getting housing and room and board, but at the same time, they're working their tails off. And they're getting their heads banged.
Mayfield's bill means players like Kyle Trask, the starting quarterback for the University of Florida, could make money to appear in Gatorade commercials, but may have to transfer if he wants to work with Powerade. But the Florida legislature isn't the body that's been standing in front of the decision on whether student athletes are paid. It's the NCAA. Tampa Senator Janet Cruz questioned if the law would jeopardize the university's compliance with the oversight body.
I wondered if you could speak to the NCAA's position on this, specifically that their board voted to let student athletes be paid for the endorsements, but after California passed a similar legislation to this, the NCAA warned California that schools could be blocked from intercollegiate events if the law provides an unfair recruiting advantage for their state schools. So I wondered if you could address that for me.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. And you know, this part of this bill is to push the NCAA to make those rules and those decisions. It's my understanding that there would be really difficult for them to block the state of Florida out from participating, since it's a pretty big state, and the universities are brings a lot of money in as well.
Mayfield also says Florida isn't alone, and if more states join, it could strengthen the push.
They will be coming in January, from what I understand, to address those rules. And our thought is the more states that pass this type of legislation, it's going to force them to make those decisions.
Mayfield is working with Lighthouse Point Republican Representative Chip LaMarca on the legislation. The bill has two more stops in the Senate, and the House version has its last committee stop Wednesday. I'm Blaze Ganey.
The Florida Department of Education, Chamber of Commerce, and early learning providers are coalescing their support for a bill that changes how the state's voluntary pre-kindergarten providers are rated and overseen. Still, as Lynn Hatter tells us, the providers say the bill isn't quite perfect.
Right now, the state's private voluntary pre-kindergarten providers are overseen by the Office of Early Learning. OEL, as it's called, is an offshoot of the Florida Department of Education, and it has its own leader. A measure by Republican Representative Aaron Grawl would clean up the reporting structure, bringing OEL under DOE.
1013 places early learning initiatives within the Department of Education as the Division of Early Learning, thereby getting rid of the Office of Early Learning as an independent entity.
It's a consolidation of sorts, one VPK organizers say is a long time coming. Something else that's been in the works for a while, taking the VPK Gold Seal Accreditation Program from under the oversight of the Department of Health and moving it to the Department of Education. Gold Seal schools would be eligible for more money from the state. All of this is good, says Erin Smeltzer. She leads the Association of Early Learning Coalitions and is giving Grawl's bill positive marks. But it's not perfect. Something that's becoming a bit of a sticking point is a provision in the measure that would rate VPK providers the same way the state grades its public schools, on an A to F scale.
You know, we've heard things from providers about how it could cause some parent confusion and that it could maybe make providers not want to participate in the program. But as a whole, like I said, the bill sponsor has really responded quickly and has worked hard with all of the stakeholders to try to make this bill incredibly meaningful.
The proposal changes the way VPK providers are rated. Right now, those ratings are based on a test students take when they start kindergarten. But providers have long complained this way of doing things is problematic because it's based on a single test at a single moment in time. Under Grawl's proposal, the new ratings would be made up from three different measures. One would review the interactions between teachers and students. Another would look at pre- and post-test to track whether kids are learning. And the third is based on the post-test to determine whether kids are ready for kindergarten. This, says Smeltzer, better captures student performance during a school year, not after.
So I think this transforms a lot of those kind of gaps that we saw in the old system into really thinking through this in a meaningful way where we look at what we know to be true as a quality indicator, the interactions, the growth that they made, regardless of where they started, and then also taking a look at how ready they were when they left the program.
Grawl notes she's not done making changes to her bill.
Of course, the conversations will continue, and in the next policy committee, we will, of course, be addressing some of the policy concerns that we've had.
And Smeltzer expects the A2F provider rating language to be revamped. I'm Lynn Hatter.
A move to end the Florida Constitution Revision Commission is set to be heard on the Senate floor this week after a controversy last year about the powerful panel tying together unrelated issues in proposed constitutional amendments. The chamber's expected to take up the measure on Wednesday of this week, which would ask Florida voters in November to do away with the panel that placed seven constitutional amendments on the 2018 ballot, all of which passed, by the way. The commission drew bipartisan criticism because it bundled together unrelated issues in single ballot measures, such as linking a ban on offshore oil drilling with a ban on vaping and workplaces. Set up by voters as part of the 1968 Florida Constitution, the 37-member commission meets every 20 years and has unique power to place proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot. Most of its members are appointed by the governor and legislative leaders. Opponents argue the commission has outlived its usefulness. The Florida House of Representatives has already approved asking voters to eliminate the commission. The legislation would require voter approval because, guess what? It's part of the Constitution. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers are supposed to wait a minimum of 6 years before returning to Tallahassee as lobbyists. The operative term is supposed to.
It would appear that it would apply to even those that were in the Senate with regards to lobbying the House.
Lawmakers want appointed officials to get more financial training.
The purpose of this bill is to ensure that folks who are appointed to oversight boards and the like actually scrutinize proposals.
Could we have a moment of silence? Well, that's what some members of the Florida legislature would like to see enshrined in law to begin each school day.
It's up to them and their parents what the content of a moment of reflection is.
And there's a new national TV network on the air from Florida's capital city. Leaders of the new Black News Channel say their prime goal is a more enlightened audience, regardless of race.
I think we can be very educational and informational in that respect.
When Florida legislators are forced out of office because of term limits, a lot of them return through the Capitol's revolving door, this time as lobbyists. That was the case involving Frank Artiles, a former senator from Miami-Dade, who was forced to resign 3 years ago. But there was just one problem, a little noticed rule in the House that prevents former lawmakers from lobbying for 6 years. Steve Bosquet has the report.
When Richard Corcoran became Speaker of the Florida House in 2016, he ushered in a series of changes in the way the House did business. They included a requirement that every spending request be filed as a separate standalone bill and that every lobbyist disclose every issue they're lobbying. A third change imposed a ban of 6 years on all former lawmakers who lobby the House after they leave office, triple the length of the state's long-standing 2-year ban.
These rules make us a national leader in transparency and accountability, and no more lobbying after our term of service is done for not 2, but not 4, but 6 years. It's the longest and strongest ban in the nation. It all ends, and it all ends today.
Those rules went into effect and faded into the background. But a few months later, Tallahassee was rocked by the case of Frank Artiles, a senator from Miami, who was forced to resign after making racist and sexist remarks to two African-American legislators one night at the Governor's Club. Artiles delivered an apology on the floor of the Senate in the 2017 session.
I extend a heartfelt apology to my colleagues and to all of those I have offended. To Senator Audrey Gibson, I apologize. I am so sorry for the words and the tone I used with you, regretfully, Monday night. My comments to you were the most regretful of all because they injured you personally.
Now Artiles has returned the same way a lot of other former legislators have, as a lobbyist. He has picked up 5 clients, including a Miami company, seeking an $8 million state grant to remove blue-green algae from Florida waterways. Artiles' name appears on the project's paperwork, but there's a major hitch. That rule from 2016 that prohibits former lawmakers from lobbying for 6 years. Artiles resigned 3 years ago. Artiles initially said the rule didn't apply to him because he was in the Senate, not the House. But House Speaker Jose Oliva did not seem to agree, even though the Speaker said Artiles made an honest mistake.
But the way the rule reads, says the legislature. So it would appear that it would apply to even those that were in the Senate with regards to lobbying the House. We're looking into it now, but yeah, I think it was a mistake. An honest mistake, I mean, in that you could see how that rule could be interpreted in 2 different ways.
Oliva and Artiles are close personal friends, but the House rules have gotten in the way. Artiles told the South Florida Sun Sentinel last week that he has decided to suspend all lobbying activity in the House until he gets a legal opinion from his attorney, Richard Coates. Said Artiles, quote, "I do not want to violate any House rules, nor do I want to do anything illegal." I'm Steve Bosquet.
Should people appointed to local state boards get more financial training? Some Florida lawmakers think so. Regan McCarthy reports a bill moving through both the House and Senate imposed fiduciary requirements and requires special training for appointed state and local government officials.
In Hillsborough County, the local airport authority made a decision. Valrico Republican Representative Mike Beltran says most people would question.
Our airport approved a car rental facility. It cost 9 figures to build the car rental facility. The anticipated benefits were only in the 8 figures. And we spent a great deal of money. Nobody in their right mind who was running a business would have ever approved that.
Beltran has a bill that would create a guiding set of fiduciary principles for appointed public officials, as well as a training program to go along with them.
The purpose of this bill is to ensure that folks who are appointed to oversight boards and the like actually scrutinize proposals, particularly proposals where large quantities of money are being spent.
Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee is sponsoring a similar bill in his chamber. He says it's not unusual to read a story in the media about an organization that failed to perform due diligence.
Over the course of about 20 years of doing this, I have seen my fair share of it. And it strikes me that as you look at Florida statute, that there, absent, you know, criminal behavior or some breach of ethics, there really is no standard under Florida law by which an individual is expected to conduct themselves as a member of these boards and commissions.
But Sarasota Democratic Representative Margaret Good points out not every decision should be based on money.
Governmental entities have to make decisions of what is in the public's best interest, and that's not necessarily a money-making the public's best interest is not necessarily an economic advantageous decision. And so my concern with this language is that we could be setting boards up for failure because they decide to spend some money that is not going to advance the economic interest of the, of the municipality or of the entity, but it will serve a purpose for the people that we serve.
And she's not the only one with concerns about the bill. Rebecca O'Hara works with the Florida League of Cities. She worries about the impact the bill could have on city managers.
If the city manager is hired by the elected body, what this would do, as I read it, would seem to give these lesser boards that serve the overall elected body would give these lesser boards kind of a ratification function over a city manager. And we're not quite sure that's where the bill was intended to go.
Both Beltran and Lee said they'd be willing to work with all involved as the bills move through the legislative process. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Sponsors of a bill that puts a moment of silence at the top of each day in Florida's public schools say it's about mitigating stress in a hectic world. The bill's cruising through both chambers, but Ryan Daly reports some are warning it's rooted in Judeo-Christian values.
Recent research proves that few people are able to experience even a moment of quiet reflection before plunging into daily life activities.
House sponsor Jacksonville Democratic Representative Kimberly Daniels wants Florida to join the 13 other states which have legislated a moment of silence into the school day.
Our students would be served well during this moment of silence to collect themselves for the day ahead, to make a mental or emotional transition from a hectic situation before school is started.
The bill has been sailing through the House. In the Senate, it awaits its final committee stop. It's being carried by Ocala Republican Dennis Baxley.
So it's really to protect the students' rights, or if they have different beliefs or they have no beliefs, that it's up to them and their parents what the content of a moment of reflection is.
The bill says teachers shall encourage parents to talk with their kids about what that silent moment means to them. Current statute permits what's called a brief meditation period, which would be replaced by a required moment of silence should the measure get signed into law. But Democratic Senator Lori Berman says what's on the books is good enough, giving school districts flexibility.
I'm not sure why we need to actually mandate it. Right now, the districts can do it if it's up to them. So I'm not going to be able to support the bill today.
Some proponents like the bill because it would mandate the moment of silence, not allowing schools to opt out. Others fear the measure would lead to discrimination of students not in Judeo-Christian religions.
I'm concerned for those students who choose not to participate with what might be considered a typical response, especially given the explicit Judeo-Christian roots of this bill.
Devin Graham with the group American Atheists has spoken against the bill in both chambers.
While sponsors assure us that nothing will happen to those kids during those 1 to 2 minutes, I fear for the retribution that will happen when the silence is over. So I can only hope when a student chooses not to bow their heads or close their eyes, who brings the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita into class to read, or chooses to pore over the litanies of Satan, or perform a silent satanic ritual at their desk, that their First Amendment rights would be acknowledged.
Baxley has been working on the bill with Rabbi Schnur Oreichman of Tallahassee's Chabad Lubavitch. Oreichman says he's behind the bill on behalf of more than 200 Chabad centers throughout Florida.
There's no better place than the school where it was faced with, unfortunately, schools were faced with a lot of darkness as well. to bring some light into the life of the children and to teach them with this moment of silence to think about other people, to think about the world, think about how they're making this world a better place.
Or Eichmann says, indeed, students can think about God or religion during their moment of silence, but they have the freedom to contemplate anything they want.
The idea is that the parents tell the children, okay, you start the day, you think about God, think about, you know, how you can make the world a better place. But this bill takes away the rights from the teachers or the principals to tell them what to think about. So a person who wants to think about nothing can think about nothing. You know, it's a moment of silence. Doesn't tell you what the silence is for, and particularly that's the language of the bill, to make it very inclusive.
If it's successful, the measure would go into effect in July of this year. I'm Ryan Daly.
Let's look ahead to Tuesday's expected action at the Capitol. Here's Gina Jordan.
Here are some of tomorrow's happenings at the Capitol. A proposal would take a series of steps to try to bolster school security. The bill comes after recommendations from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission. The panel was created by the state after the mass shooting in Parkland 2 years ago. A law that prevents harassment of people hunting, trapping, or fishing may be expanded. Penalties may go up for people who kill bears or possess freshly killed bears during closed seasons. Penalties may also be increased for numerous types of environmental violations. Dental therapists may be established as a new type of licensed healthcare provider. Two Democratic lawmakers will hold news conferences. North Miami Beach Senator Jason Pizzo will discuss efforts to expand access to dental care, while Riverview Representative Adam Hattersley will highlight a proposal to amend the Florida Endangered and Threatened Species Act. Several Republicans will hold a joint news conference to promote legislation they say would reform policies that lead to the suspension of driver's licenses for unpaid fines and fees. And finally, an overhaul of the state's alimony laws is in the works. That's some of what's happening tomorrow at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
Of course, Floridians will vote in the state's presidential primary election next month. The Democratic field of candidates remains crowded, and they'll have to convince South Florida voters in order to have a shot at winning the state. On the South Florida Roundup, host Tom Hudson talked about the Democratic race with Telemundo 51 anchor Gloria Ordaz and Miami Herald politics reporter David Smiley.
What are you seeing, what are you sensing in terms of the ground game of these campaigns while still crowded in the primary in Florida with early outreach in the Hispanic voting community?
Well, I think it's very important to mention that this year, for the first time, Latinos are expected to be the largest minority in the U.S. presidential election. And I think that the Democratic candidates have a problem because in terms of the Hispanic community, the candidates are non-existent. They are basically invisible. They don't have a visibility here in South Florida.
It's such an interesting observation, David. What about that early outreach on the part of surrogates, in the part of the ground game, in the part of the field work that you can't turn on after Super Tuesday in early March and just flip a switch and go to work in Florida?
Right. You know, Joe Biden has tried to build a very large stable of surrogates. I think the Democratic candidates, whether it be this presidential cycle or going back to the gubernatorial election, have struggled to connect with Hispanic voters, particularly with non-party affiliated Hispanic voters, which won't matter in a Democratic primary, although there is some effort by, say, the Warren campaign to reach out to independent voters. I went around with her campaign in Little Havana a couple months ago, and they were knocking on doors mm-hmm. of independent voters trying to talk to them about Elizabeth Warren and hopefully eventually convince them to register as Democrats to vote for her. But they have a problem generally connecting, particularly with South Florida's Hispanic community, because it's just a very different diaspora yeah. than it is in other areas
yeah.
of the country.
Yeah, Gloria, it's not monolithic, right? I mean, that's
exactly.
We know this. Yeah,
and they have to understand something, and this is very important. The Hispanic voters in South Florida are very different, and their priorities are very different from other Hispanic voters in the country, because most of the Hispanic voters that live here in South Florida, they have came fleeing regimes, dictatorial regimes, fleeing socialist regime. The biggest challenge with Hispanic voters is dealing with the socialist brand. What is happening now is that most Hispanic voters see the Democratic candidate, a Democrat, any Democratic candidate, doesn't matter who he is, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, or Pete Buttigieg, that of course we know that he's no socialist, but most of the Hispanic voters see them as a brand, as a socialist, and they have to be very specific when they engage with the community, specifically here in South Florida. And also, I think that candidates here in South Florida should think of Latino interest beyond immigration. Mm-hmm. Because if you are an immigrant, U.S. citizen, and you vote, you don't have an immigration problem. Morally, you should, you know, of course, defend the immigration because other people like you, but you don't have it. So your topics, your priorities are going to be jobs, are going to be economy, affordable college, minimum wage, other issues that they need to discuss when they make that approach and that engagement with the Hispanic voters.
That was an excerpt from last Friday's episode of the South Florida Roundup. You heard from Telemundo 51 anchor Gloria Ordaz and David Smiley. He reports on politics for WLRN's news partner, the Miami Herald. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Tallahassee is now the home of a brand new 24-hour television network. The Black News Channel officially launched today. Victoria Dominguez reports it's projected to reach millions of households across the nation.
The network says what sets it apart from other news channels is its coverage of Black communities. The Black News Channel includes talk shows for Black women and teenagers and plans to highlight historically Black colleges and universities. J.C. Watts is the chairman of the BNC. He's a former Republican congressman from Oklahoma. He says the channel is meant to represent the lived experiences of African Americans instead of a particular ideology.
Any African American that is 45 years of age, if they're honest, I don't care if they're liberal or conservative, and they tell me of an experience that they've had, I can say, me too.
Watts says the BNC is in talks to expand the channel to digital and streaming services.
If people come minus their biases and says, I do want to learn. I want to know more about, you know, sickle cell. Well, I think we can be very educational and informational.
The Black News Channel is available to viewers using Dish, Spectrum, Comcast, or Xfinity X1. I'm Victoria Dominguez.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Victoria Dominguez. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us every weeknight at this time throughout the 2020 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org.